keeping Fido and Fluffy healthy this summer. It's a great time of year to get outside with your pets, but it's time to be cautious as well. After all, just like humans, dogs and cats can get heat stroke. They can contract several dangerous illnesses from ticks, and they can get sunburns and even melanoma. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, we will talk with two local veterinarians about keeping your pets healthy this summer. Our experts will answer your pet care questions, and we'll discuss the latest news about the FDA investigation into grain-free dog food. It's been linked to a common type of canine heart disease. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. As much joy as our pets bring us, they can also bring challenges. We'll talk today with veterinarians about summer concerns, from hot weather to ticks to being around water. And we will take your questions about the health and safety of our beloved four-legged friends. Joining me in our studio, Dr. Carrie Whittemore. She is a veterinarian with Falmouth Veterinary Hospital. And Dr. Virginia Gill is a veterinary oncologist with the Maine Veterinary Medical Center. As always, we want to hear from you. Do you have concerns about traveling with or without your pet? Have you encountered many ticks this season? Are you worried about signs of illness or disease? Well, you can ask all of those questions at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can send us a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Dr. Whittemore, I want to start with something that's in the news. Big news today that the FDA is going to be or is investigating grain-free dog foods. And I'm wondering if you're surprised by this and if you would like to explain kind of what this is all about.
So it's not just grain-free dog foods. It's also what we would call like boutique dog foods, which are dog foods that are made by companies that are smaller, I would say, on a smaller scale. And so the big concern is just that basically there's some research coming out that we are seeing dogs with cardiac conditions as a result of these diets. Like I said, it's not just grain-free, but these boutique diets often contain different like meat protein sources, like things like emu and kangaroo and things like that, that haven't been substantiated in terms of how well they transfer into feedstuffs for animals. So it's more about how they're formulated and if they're formulated to fit standards by what we call AFCO, which is, I'm going to forget it now, the American Association of Animal Feedstuffs,
right.
Feed officials. And so what that does is it regulates what can and can't be in dog food and what the minimum requirements are for like protein and carbohydrates and certain like amino acids that are important in the body. And so these oftentimes aren't as well regulated or don't have the same quality control as larger companies do. And so there is some concern that they're not being formulated to meet these standards, and thus these animals are basically developing these conditions, potentially cardiac specifically.
You know, and part of the thing that's frustrating about this is, you know, the folks who are spending extra money on these kinds of pet foods really care about their animals,
right,
and are trying to do the right thing.
Yep.
Absolutely. I will say that, you know, this is something that I have a question about almost every appointment. There's some literature out there that in the human world that says that higher protein, lower carb diets are better for patients with cancer. So we think, you know, if we can starve those cancer cells of their preferred food, which is carbohydrates, thereby feeding a higher protein diet and grain-free diet, are we going to be helping our pets with cancer? So I have this question practically every appointment.
Yeah, me too.
And I think it's really important just to remember, look at the bag, see if it says that it's AFCO certified. If it says it's AFCO certified, you're good. So don't freak out too much about this news. Really, the important thing is when you go into the pet store, you see all those amazing looking diets, pick one that says that it's AFCO certified.
All right. Well, we'll move on to some other topics now. And I just want to ask you generally what you all are seeing with your canine patients and your feline patients every day. Are there things going on out there right now?
Skin, summer allergies, in general, hot spots. I would say yesterday I saw 5 skin cases alone. Fleas, although I'm not seeing much of them, but fleas are always a big issue this time of year as well, especially like in feline patients, because oftentimes we have indoor kitties who aren't on any preventatives, and they still can get fleas potentially. So that's what I'm seeing for the most part.
Okay. And what about you?
And for me, I do oncology, so I see oncology sort of all the time. So as far as summer stuff goes, a lot of clients worried about ticks, again, and fleas. Again, you know, a lot of times my clients are coming to me with concerns about should they be using this tick preventative, should they be using that tick preventative. So those things are sort of always cropping up. Dogs that are getting into porcupines, that tends to be a really huge summer issue. And so my patients will come in and, you know, they're being treated for cancer, but they also happen to have run into a porcupine.
Oh, my goodness. You know what I was interested to learn in doing some reading this morning, Dr. Gill, is that dogs can get melanoma. It seems
Absolutely.
Counterintuitive because they're covered with fur.
Right. And it's a little bit different. So people get melanoma of the skin. That's our common form of melanoma. In dogs, it happens in the mouth and on the toe, so in the actual nail bed. And when you have it in those two spots, it behaves just like it does in the skin of people, whereas if it does happen in the skin of dogs, it's actually benign. Mm. So if you've got a little sort of black pigmented thing on the skin of a dog and it's small, you know, and you think it could be a melanoma, probably nothing to worry about, versus if you see a black mass in the mouth or a black mass on the toe, that's a melanoma you need to be worried about.
Are those likely caused by the sun still or not?
No. Nope. No correlation to sun. There are some sun tumors, so cats, white dogs, usually sunnier places than Maine that do a lot of sunbathing, so dogs that like to lay on their backs and sort of get a lot of sun, can get some sun-related cancer, squamous cell carcinomas, but melanomas are not related to sun in dogs.
I'm sorry the cancer isn't funny, but I had an image right then
no,
of one of our
I
neighbor
know.
Dogs who likes to lay in the driveway, belly
right?
up.
Yeah, you definitely know those dogs are so cute.
Yeah, and what about, and I also read this morning, Dr. Whittemore, that really isn't a good idea to shave your dog, even if you think, oh, it's so hot out there and that's going to feel so good to that dog.
It depends on the type of coat they have, definitely. If your dog is regularly groomed, that's one thing. But in general, you know, they've evolved over millions of years to be what they are. And so their coat acts as a natural kind of cooling. They will seek, there's a reason that they like to lay on cool floors or near fans and things like that. Their body is made to help them conduct or reserve heat.
All right. It's not too hot today, but we've had some hot weather and there's more to come. What are signs to look out for that your dog may be overheating in a dangerous way? You know, all dogs pant when they go on a walk in the summertime. But beyond that, what do we need to look out for?
So I would say in general, I mean, obvious excessive panting, particularly a lot of drooling, you know, salivating essentially, weakness, if they really just can't seem to catch their breath. Pale gum color is another one to look for because these dogs often become hypotensive or have low blood pressure as a result of overheating. So looking at gum color is always really important. Hmm. And it also breed tendencies. So those brachycephalic breeds are smushed face dogs. So bulldogs, French bulldogs, Bostons, Pekingese, those types of dogs are also very prone to overheating just because the shape of their face prevents them from really cooling air very well. So those are other dogs really to watch out for heat stroke and things like that.
All right. If you have a question about your pet for our veterinarians today, the phone number 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. I'd like to ask you, Dr. Gill, since I have you here, there are some sort of myths out there about pets and cancer, and I'm wondering what you're hearing commonly and what you'd like to debunk if you have the chance.
That is a great question. So what do I hear commonly? A really simple one is that a lot of times people worry that certain cancers are contagious, and there are almost no cancers out there that are contagious. So worrying about if you have one pet with cancer, is the other pet in the household going to, you know, get that cancer? And that is virtually non-existent. So just putting people's mind at ease that that's not going to happen. The other thing, you know, people are always looking for a cause of cancer. You know, did I do something to cause this? Is this my fault? And, you know, in the same sort of line, there's not a lot of cancers that we do know the cause for, which is frustrating, but there's really not. People will come in and say, I feed them the best food. I don't ever put any tick preventative on them. I try to be as natural as possible, and my pet still has cancer. And it's great that you're doing those things. It's great that you're, you know, loving them and taking care of them so much, but it's likely not, you know, that those things are going to prevent your pet from getting cancer. So really just being very vigilant about watching your pet, making sure that they're getting a yearly exam, making sure that you're not seeing things like weight loss, you know, not wanting to eat, just sort of subtle signs, and always kind of making sure that you're cluing into those things that sort of might translate into illness, more so than being absolutely sure that you're keeping them, you know, entirely chemical free, or making sure that you're feeding them the most sort of boutique diet that you can find.
Well, let me ask you about this, because you're talking about tick preventative. Was one of the things you mentioned, and I put a tick preventative on my dog, but it does feel like, oh gosh, I'm putting a chemical right onto the skin of my dog.
So I actually have the same feeling, and so I understand why people say that, like, oh, I'm putting this chemical on my dog. But on the flip side of that, we know that those tick-borne diseases are just so devastating. Like, we know that Lyme disease is so devastating. We know that the ehrlichiosis diseases are so devastating. And we don't have any data to say that those tick preventatives do cause cancer or do cause diseases. So I try to really weigh the pros and cons with cancer, or with those products. And especially, again, in my patients that have cancer, clients are really, really worried about putting that stuff on there. They don't want to be putting a chemical on their dog that could have any link to causing cancer. So I try to just really sort of ease that anxiety by saying, look, we have absolutely no data to say that that is a link. So many dogs and cats get these products. And if it was a link, I think we would be seeing things. And the diseases that ticks cause are just so darn bad that please keep up with your regular tick preventatives.
And you mentioned the diseases. Why don't you tell us, Carrie, some of those diseases that you're seeing that are caused by ticks? I mean, obviously Lyme disease.
Lyme and anaplasma is probably the other one that's up and coming, because it transmits a lot faster than Lyme disease. So Lyme disease takes about 36 hours to transmit. So a lot of the products that are currently on the market are really geared towards Lyme, because Lyme was the big one. But anaplasma is the other one. So it's transmitted by the same tick as Lyme disease. It's the deer tick. And oftentimes you can get co-infection with Lyme and with anaplasma. And the problem with it is that you can have pets that basically what it can cause is, just like Lyme, sometimes you have no symptoms whatsoever, but in other instances, you can have immune-mediated disease where basically it starts to destroy red blood cells, white blood cells, and platelets. So it can cause bleeding as well in animals. So it's something that I've probably seen two or three cases in the last year that I've been at Falmouth, and it's no joke. You give them doxycycline and it typically takes care of it, but there are some pets that can be very ill with it.
I read this morning some recommendation that dogs and cats ought to be screened for tick-borne diseases, even if there's no signs, that just as part of their you're agreeing, just as part of their regular checkup.
Yeah, and the other thing to remember about it too is that we're screening them obviously because we're concerned about them. But if they have had exposure to these diseases, you spend time with your animals, you take your dogs for hikes, the likelihood that you've potentially been exposed is also there. So it's also helping monitor kind of human interaction with ticks as well. I think that's one thing that's important to remember, because people will say to us, well, they're on it year round, why do I need to do this test? And it's one thing, you know, nothing in life is 100%. The other thing, like I said, is that you spend a lot of time with your pets. If your pets have been exposed, the likelihood that you've been exposed is also there.
Are you finding cases where you've just done an annual test and the owner had no idea that the dog had Lyme disease or anaplasmosis?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll go to the calls now. We're going to start with Wheezy calling from Falmouth. Hi, Wheezy. Go ahead. I hear your dogs.
Oh, hi there. Sorry. I was just calling in regarding, I have a greyhound who, she's 7 years old and she's suffering from some urinary incontinence issues. And I just wasn't sure what, you know, sort of treatments might be available.
Hi, Wheezy. It's Dr. Whittemore. How are you?
Hi, I'm good, thank you.
Good. So my recommendation would be for you to go to your vet and make sure that there's not an infection going on, because sometimes that can cause incontinence in dogs most frequently. And in female dogs, they also can have a condition called urethral sphincter incompetence, where older female dogs will sometimes leak some urine, but we always want to make sure there's no infection there first before we start treating.
Okay. Yeah, I wasn't sure if, the, you know, if, well, yeah, okay. I guess that'll do it.
Thank you so much, Easy. Good luck.
Thank you.
We have an email from Lori. I have a 10-year-old female cat that for the last 3 years has been getting steroids shots 2 times a year for her asthma. The asthma was discovered when I thought she had a non-productive hairball cough, but then she started licking a spot on her stomach raw, and that's when I took her to the vet. The steroid shot seemed to have worked great for both the cough and the licking. Unfortunately, this time, last time she had her shot, the licking didn't stop. My vet has suggested we do labs to see if anything shows up, although she didn't sound very sure. I know you can't offer a diagnosis. However, I was wondering if you're curious if you've ever come across this type of behavior, and if so, what should I do next?
Hi there. Thanks for the email. So it sounds like maybe originally it was something that was steroid responsive, but there's certainly the possibility that there's a secondary issue going on. So I do agree with your vet. I think doing some labs to look at some blood work, maybe doing some skin scrapes, actually seeing if there's infection at that site now that needs to be treated, mites, you know, anything that could be going along secondary to the original problem.
And an email from Peg. I love my cat, but he is stressing me. He uses the litter box, sort of. A couple years ago, he started urinating just outside the opening of the litter box. He doesn't seem to be disturbed about anything. I put the litter box inside a larger plastic container and put pet training pads on the bottom of the larger box to absorb the urine. It stinks. And there she's got some more details about the dimensions of the boxes. He's an indoor cat. Has always been, except for the screen porch where another litter box is set up. We hear cat litter box issues a lot, don't we?
Yes, we do. The biggest thing, I think, the same kind of thing along the lines of Wheezy's question, is that always we want to rule out that there might be some sort of infection. Even though he's not showing any symptoms of it, that's always good to rule out. And then the other thing is that always remembering that stressors for cats are different than what stressors are for humans. And so any change in the household or a change in litter, anything like that can oftentimes make cats stressed out. So ruling out infection and then looking for potentially behavioral causes after that.
All right. Well, we do have to go to a quick break. But before that, I want to mention that we have people posting pictures of their pets on our Facebook post today. And if you'd like to comment with a picture of your pet, we'd love it. And if you'd like to just look at the cute pets that have already been posted, do that as well. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do St. Mary's Health System Orthopedics, helping patients live their best lives in motion, online at findabonedoctorme.org. And Norris, helping businesses and schools stay safe through engineered security, life safety, and emergency communication systems. NorrisInc.com.
The court-imposed deadline to reunite families has arrived, and we'll be on the Texas border reporting on what life is like for immigrants and the lawyers working to help them.
Well, I don't want to give up. I'm going to stay optimistic, even if everything's going against them.
I'm Ari Shapiro, reporting from South Texas on the effort to reunite parents and children this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 each weekday evening.
Radio the way it should be. Listening to public radio is one of those things that seems to be right on the mark. That's what we hear from so many of you these days. Hi, Charles Beck here. The relevance of this essential service is clear in your life and for our communities. The service has grown to what it is today because concerned and active listeners, we call them supporters, have made it all possible. And each of us, as we listen day in and day out and understand more fully those important issues, grow as individuals as well. So let's grow together in the days and months ahead. Please do your financial part on Super Thursday, August 2nd, our one-day on-air campaign, or make your contribution right now online at mainepublic.org. And thanks for keeping and making public radio strong here in Maine.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, news and advice about your dogs, cats, and other pets. Joining me on the program today, Virginia Gill. She's a veterinary oncologist with the Maine Veterinary Medical Center. And Carrie Whittemore is a veterinarian with the Falmouth Veterinary Hospital. We invite you to join the conversation with your questions. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Joining me on the line now is Sarah Sweet. She's a veterinarian and medical affairs manager with IDEX. Sarah, thanks for calling in.
Thank you.
What are we seeing with ticks in Maine this summer? Are there more? Are we seeing more problems than before?
I don't know. I don't know that we're seeing more. What we've found necessarily this summer, what we've found is over the years, there's been a gradual increase in sort of people's concerns about ticks on their animals. We tend to see people say in the summertime that, gosh, I'm just not seeing as many. It's not as bad. And then in the fall, they seem surprised when we see more ticks. And what I used to tell my clients was spring and fall are when they seem to be the most active, but you can see ticks any time of the year. And while we may not see them 365 days a year, we will certainly see them 12 months out of a year.
What is different about a dog getting a tick bite than a human?
So when dogs get tick bites, and I think Dr. Gill and Dr. Whittemore would probably agree, typically they get this sort of a welt that you'll see. They do not typically get the bullseye rash that people get. So I think that's a little bit of a misperception, is that people think if they see a bullseye rash, or if they don't see a bullseye rash, that their dog has not been bitten by a tick. But the thing that we've got to remember is that ticks are much more difficult to find on our dogs and cats because of their fur coat, you know, their hair coats. And so while we are very vigilant about checking ourselves, I think it's sometimes easier to miss in some of our pets. And so that's why it's very important to make sure that you use the preventatives and that you check your pets regularly for ticks, and also check them for diseases as a part of their annual physical exam.
And I want to mention that we posted on our Facebook page an article by the CDC about how to look for ticks on your dog, and I found the graphic really interesting and helpful. Before I let you go, I want to ask you about the link between some tick bites and kidney disease in dogs. This is turning out to be a very common link, isn't it?
It is, and this is a study that we conducted fairly recently here at IDEX, where we looked at the likelihood that a dog that was bitten by a tick and tested positive for either Lyme disease or ehrlichiosis, and Dr. Gill had mentioned ehrlichiosis. We don't see that very much here in Maine, but it's certainly something that I think is on people's radar, veterinarians' radar, as we see warming winters and so on. I think that that's something we'll deal with in the future. But what we found was that dogs that were bitten by a tick that had Lyme disease and they contracted Lyme disease had a 43% greater risk of developing chronic kidney disease later in life. And dogs that were infected with Ehrlichia, which is another tick-borne disease, had a 300% greater risk of developing chronic kidney disease. And so just to reinforce one of the things that Dr. Gill said about the physical exam and animals not necessarily showing outward physical signs of illness, they don't necessarily need to be sick, obviously sick, to have been exposed to some of these infectious diseases. And so this is one of the reasons that your veterinarian will recommend that you conduct annual testing in addition to the physical exam. And that's, I liken it to us as people. When we go to our physician, they check our blood pressure and they check our cholesterol and they check all these things that we're happy when they're normal. And so I think we need to start looking at some of these diagnostic tests, like the annual tick test that a lot of veterinarians do here, the SNAP 40X Plus test. I think we need to look at those as something to celebrate when they're normal.
All right. Well, Sarah Sweet, thanks so much for calling in. Dr. Sarah Sweet, a veterinarian with IDEX. We go to Terry's question from Facebook. She writes, my dogs love to swim. They wear life jackets, and I swim with them about 20 minutes a day. Is it possible to swim a dog too much? Is half an hour too much?
Hi, Terry. I think that's amazing. I wish I was one of your dogs. That sounds so wonderful. If your dogs are seeming like they can handle 20 minutes of swimming, great. You know, they'll work up athletic endurance just the way that you and I would. So if they seem like they can handle 30 minutes, also great. I think it's an individual thing and just monitoring and making sure that they're not seeming like they're overexerted with the amount of time you've got them in the water. And the life jackets are going to help them as well.
All right, we're going to go to Bob calling from Solon. Hi, Bob. Go ahead.
I have two questions. One is about hot spots. I have a Siberian Husky, and she's really going after herself this summer. And the second is flies and flying insects. She seems to have a big phobia on that, and she's running around the house all the time looking for flies, and she's going from room to room. Any advice on either of those subjects?
So for hot spots, I mean, if she's really going after herself, the big thing about hot spots is they can turn into something big very quickly, usually an infection of the skin that sometimes will require clipping the hair coat to expose it to the air, as well as topical and oral antibiotics. So, you know, definitely checking in with your veterinarian. If she has these spots that aren't going away, she may need some medical intervention. The flies, she might be chasing because they're fun.
Yeah, okay. She already has seen a vet because she almost chewed her front paw off right
Aww.
Down. There's blood everywhere. So we've taken care of that, but she still gets the hot spots. I don't know if there's any way to help with that.
Does she have any kind of allergies potentially?
No, it's just this hot weather. In the wintertime, she's fine.
Yeah, so it could still be related to some allergies. So I think potentially talking to your veterinarian about, you know, she could have some allergies to grass or any of the trees. You know, Maine is definitely known for its pollen. So oftentimes, and it can develop over a lifetime. Allergies don't just, you know, aren't just born with them. Sometimes you have them and then they can get worse with age. So I think maybe investigating that avenue with your veterinarian would be a good idea.
Bob, good luck with her, and I bet that's quite a sight—a Siberian Husky running through the house chasing flies. Thank you. Let's see here. Laura on Facebook says, "I'm using the Seresto collar, good for 8 months, and have really good luck—no ticks, fleas, or hot spots. Wonder what your guests think of this product."
I actually love the Seresto collar. I don't do preventative medicine as my primary care, but I get lots and lots of questions every day about primary care type stuff. And I really like the Seresto collar. I think clients really like that they can put it on and off. It does need to be on for a certain amount of time to, you know, provide the right protection, but you can take it off. And so, you know, at night, if you don't want to have it on them, you don't necessarily have to. So I don't know. My experience with it has been quite positive.
Yeah, I think it's really great because, like you said, like there are people in terms of, you know, not wanting to use, you know, put chemicals on top of their dogs or things like that. This works kind of by like a friction action. And it's just, I think for a lot of people, the biggest thing is compliance. So I self-confess, always forget to give my dog his flea and tick preventative. So I have to put it on my calendar. But this way, you have 8 months where you don't have to worry about giving them a pill or putting something on their skin. It's on them, it stays on them, and it seems to do the job very well.
We'll go to Claudia calling from Phippsburg. Hi, Claudia. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. This goes back to earlier when one of your guests was talking about cancer in pets. I have lost a beloved dog and cat to cancer, and I want to warn people about a preservative that I learned about after that. It is still allowed to be used in pet food. It is so hazardous that human beings who work with it have to suit up in hazmat gear, but they put it in pet food as a preservative. It is called ethoxyquin, ethoxyquin, and it's listed near the end as a preservative on the ingredients list.
Claudia, your phone call is kind of going in and out, so I think we've got what you've said, though. Dr. Gill, is this something you've heard about?
It's truthfully not something that's really on my radar, but thank you, Claudia. I really appreciate you bringing it up. And I think it's great to be sort of as vigilant as possible. Thanks.
All right. We'll move on. We'll move to Elaine, who's calling from Surrey. Hi, Elaine. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, we have our dog develops what we call dermatitis. Actually, the fellow who called about hot spots, I'm not sure if there's a difference there, but he chews at himself, and this happens anyway during humid weather particularly, and he's just gotten through a round of prednisone, which always clears it up. But I was wondering if a haircut in the summer, he's a little terrier dog with the wiry hair and shaggy coat, and I was wondering if a full body haircut would help. And also, he likes to go in the water, not to swim, but to lay down, and I was wondering if we should keep him from the water on hot days because the dampness might aggravate this. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so definitely. So the one difference between dermatitis and a hot spot, so technically a hot spot is what's called acute moist dermatitis. So it is typically caused by trauma by the pet licking it themselves, and they create an infection. So dermatitis itself, itis at the end of a word basically means inflammation. So dermatitis means inflammation of the skin itself. And so not necessarily a haircut, but oftentimes shampooing your pet will help to remove some of the pollens and things that they might be allergic to from their hair coat. Terriers, depending on their coat, you don't necessarily want to clip them. But in terms of him being in the water, I would just be more concerned. Again, they can develop hot spots. So just making sure to rinse him off after he's been laying in the water, essentially to remove any debris away from his coat and skin that might basically precipitate a hot spot to happen.
All right. We have Sherry on Facebook saying, my very athletic lab has injured her rear leg. One vet says she's healing naturally. Another one says she has a partial cruciate tear and needs MMP surgery. How do I know what I should do? I want to do what's best for her.
Hi there. I'm so sorry to hear about your pet. If it's something that's been going on for a long time, there's a couple of options. You could consider getting some x-rays done. You could consider going to see a surgeon. Surgeons are great at diagnosing a cruciate tear. Similar to us when we have an ACL tear, and lots of athletic breeds do have that happen to them. So, you know, not to sort of repeat the same thing, but either going back to your regular vet if it's something that's going on for a long time and considering some x-rays, or you could always seek specialty care and see a surgeon and dig a little deeper.
All right, we'll go to Kevin, who's calling from Newry. Hi, Kevin, go ahead.
Hi, yes, I have a kennel of 34 working sled dogs. And I was wondering what your guest vets would recommend as the most cost-effective treatment for tick-borne disease preventions. We gave them Bravecto this year. I contacted Merck ahead of time to see if they have any kind of professional discount programs for kennel owners and all that, and they were very unhelpful. Our local vet has been very helpful, giving it to him at his cost, but it's a significant expense, and I'd just like their input on that.
That's a good question. Sure, any treatment times 34 has got to get expensive. Thoughts?
Seresto might be a good one, potentially because of the length of how it, I mean, I don't know how much your vet charges for it, but just the length, if you probably price it out per month, it may be the most cost effective. And I mean, I understand about Bravecto and things like that as well. But I think, you know, if you break it down per month rather than the upfront cost, that might help you to kind of sort out what is the most cost effective way to treat your dogs.
Good luck, Kevin. I'm sure that's a sight. 34 sled dogs. I bet that's a lot of fun. Thank you for calling. We're going to go to Mark calling from Portland. Hi, Mark. Go ahead.
Hi there. I'm calling about my little kitty cat. I live on the ground floor of a beautiful little apartment here in Maine, and I got a patch of woods next door. And I was adopted by a little black cat. I estimated he's less than a year old. And my lease says I can't have a cat, so he and I made an agreement. We reached a working agreement. I take care of my elimination needs indoors, and he takes care of his outdoors. And I rigged up the door so he can come and go at his own will. And unlike me, when I get a belly full of food, I don't want to go out and hunt down a restaurant. But he gets a belly full of good cat food and dry crunchies. And he goes out at night and he hunts. He is a mighty hunter. And he brings some of his catch back and drops it on the bed next to me when I'm sleeping. I've waked up next to lizards and mice and a couple of rats. And I've been letting him eat those animals, and he's getting worms from them, and I've been dosing him with garlic, and he's gotten used to eating his canned cat food with garlic in it. And I'm calling to ask if that's effective, or am I just wasting my time? And the only thing I could do is to stop him from eating his rats.
Okay, but this is a good question. So if an animal, a cat, catches critters and eats them, can that cat get worms, and is treating it with garlic a good idea?
So, yes, they can get intestinal parasites from things that they eat. And garlic is not proven to be effective and actually can sometimes be toxic to animals in particular. So, you know, they do, you know, I know that you've kind of adopted him and you guys have this agreement. They do sell kind of broad spectrum dewormers over the counter potentially, or, you know, having him checked out by a veterinarian, again, to make sure you can actually test his stool to see if he has any worms and confirm that and then come up with a treatment plan from there.
All right. Well, good luck, Mark, to you. We'll go to another Mark. This Mark is calling from Searsmont. Hi, Mark. Go ahead.
Hi. So I'd like to, I guess, just ask about, you know, I guess, tick medications. I have a 8-year-old Irish Wolfhound lab mix. And she's been on Bravecto for a bit, and while it definitely seems to be helping, it's almost kind of like a double-edged sword situation. It's like I ended up getting her groomed because it's so impossible to see the ticks, but then now I have to worry about possible, you know, overheating and issues like that. I hear just great things about Seresto, but I just don't know if I want to make the switch over just yet. But I guess it's just where I am in Searsmont. I mean, I can't even walk out in the front yard without having to check her almost every time. And just didn't know if there's anything easier or any easier ways that can be helpful. She definitely looks to be uncomfortable, and I end up wasting at least an hour a day doing full body checks for me, my wife, and my 90-pound dog and my 2 indoor cats. So I just
okay, Mark,
like
thank you.
It.
Yeah, I'll see what the veterinarians say.
Hi, Mark. I guess if the Bravecto seems to be doing the job, I know it's really tiresome to be doing those tick checks, but I think it's great that you're doing them. If the Bravecto seems to be doing the job, I might stick with the Bravecto. I don't know if you have anything to add, Dr. Whittemore.
I usually say if it's not broke, don't fix it. You know, if you're having success with it. And some people will, I will say some people will double up. If you feel like, you know, you're having a hard time, you can use Seresto with the Bravecto together. You know, again, like Dr. Sweet was talking about, you know, spring and fall tend to be the times of year that we have the most. But depending on where you are, I have to say that's one thing about Maine is that there seem to be these pockets of where tick activity is definitely higher. And if you feel like that is, you know, doubling up. And again, Seresto collars are, you know, a relatively monthly, and, you know, if you count it out month wise, you know, it's relatively inexpensive. So doubling up may be an option as well to try and put your mind at ease.
Well, Mark, thanks for your call and good luck to you. We do have to take a quick break. But first, a word about tomorrow's program. We're going to be talking about young adult literature. So if you have questions or comments about it, tell us your favorite book, maybe. Email your comments and questions to talk@mainpublic.org. In the meantime, our phone number for today's program about veterinary medicine, 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens, celebrating the botany of butterflies with the opening of their new native butterfly and moth house, open daily until October 31st. And Evergreen Home Performance, offering energy-efficient windows and insulation to help homeowners achieve year-round comfort. More at evergreenyourhome.com.
Provincetown, Massachusetts lost many people to the AIDS crisis of the 1980s.
And that's what Provincetown has sincerely afforded, is that sense of you're more than the disease, you're still a human being.
Now a new memorial helps remember the lives lost to the disease and those who helped to care for them. On Next from the New England News Collaborative, we'll also dig into the numbers behind HIV diagnoses today, and we'll hear about which communities are disproportionately affected. Please join us.
And you can join us for next tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock. Today at 2, following Maine Calling, join us for City Arts and Lectures. Today's speaker, Dr. Diane Ehrensaft, author of Gender Born, Gender Made, speaks about children and gender identity and how this complex situation is best dealt with by parents, teachers, and healthcare providers. That's City Arts and Lectures coming up at 2 following Maine Calling here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, answers to your pet questions. Joining us today, Dr. Carrie Whittemore with Falmouth Veterinary Hospital and Dr. Virginia Gill with Maine Veterinary Medical Center. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Claudia asks on Facebook, seems like cancer in cats and dogs is on the upswing in recent years. If it is it because diagnosis is better? Is it the environment, foods, etc.? Is it true? Is cancer on the upswing?
That is such a million-dollar question. I would agree that it does seem like it is on the upswing. Whether or not it really is sort of hard to answer. And I think there's a lot of different reasons for why we might be either one, seeing a true upswing, or two, noticing it more. As far as noticing it more, we just do more pet care. Like, we are much more as a society. We have more specialized veterinary medicine than we used to, and people are pursuing treatments that used to not be pursued. So that does make it seem more prevalent. And then I think the question that we don't really know is, if it is really more prevalent, why? Is there more in the environment that's potentially leading to that? I don't really think it's a food issue. I think, if anything, potentially environment. Also, I guess the other thing to bring up is breed. So a lot of, not a lot, but there are some breed-specific cancers out there. And as breeds become more popular, for one, golden retrievers, which are the most wonderful, lovable dogs out there, but also happen to be quite prone to several different types of cancers. So as we're seeing sort of more of a particular breed, we might also be seeing more cancer.
We'll go to Barbara, who's calling from Prospect Harbor. Hi, Barbara. Go ahead.
Thank you. I have my first. I've always had German Shepherd dogs, and I have always done rescues. And I have this German Shepherd now that she's 4.5 years old, and she has the struvite, I think that's what they're called, struvite crystals in her urine. So she has to, she's giving her pills.
Barbara, you need to turn down your radio, I think.
Oh, okay. Okay, I'll turn it off. Okay, so I took her to the vet, and the vet said she needs to have the Hill's urinary care food that I should add water to. So I have been doing that. But her father, the dog's father, is allergic to chicken, and that is the only flavor that this Hill's stuff comes in. And I had been giving her, I don't know, one of those quality foods. But
wondering if she could perhaps be allergic to the Hill's urinary care because her father was. Do you have thoughts?
So not necessarily. That's a good question. So allergies are not necessarily a genetic sort of predisposition. So just because her father was potentially allergic to chicken, you would have to do a diet trial to ensure that chicken truly is what she is allergic to. So, you know, depending on what you've been feeding her previously, you know, slowly transitioning her onto the new diet and seeing if you're, you know, seeing any reactions in terms of, you know, vomiting, diarrhea, any changes in skin, itchiness, things like that. You know, that way you can possibly tell if she's going to have an allergic reaction to it.
Okay, good luck to you, Barbara. This is a question from the Veterinary and Rehabilitation Center of Cape Elizabeth. We always refer patients diagnosed with cancer to a veterinary oncologist, but owners are often reluctant to go because they are worried about side effects of treatments, especially if they've had any experience with a human going through treatment. Could Dr. Gill address what types of side effects can be expected and how great the benefits can be to help put these fears to rest.
Hi, guys. Great to hear from you. Thank you so much for calling in. So I think that's a really, really important thing and something that we discuss in every single appointment because people come in obviously scared to treat their dog for cancer. So one, you know, coming to a seeing oncologist is a lot of just a conversation, finding out what we might be able to do and getting to the bottom of things and making sure we know what we're dealing with. So it's not necessarily that you're going to definitely make the decision to treat, but you're hopefully going to arm yourself with a lot of education to then make a good decision. And then two, thankfully, chemotherapy in dogs is completely different than it is in people for a really big reason. You know, our dogs are dogs, our cats are cats. We want them to have good, happy, healthy lives, and we don't want them to be miserable. So we focus on quality of life. That's our entire thing is, can I help your pet have a better quality of life? We treat at lower doses, and really the vast majority of times, dogs tolerate chemo, and cats actually tolerate chemo really, really well. I'm usually telling people, you know, there's a 90% chance that your dog's not going to have side effects, may actually feel better because we're treating the disease. Very small chance that we're going to have some side effects that we can deal with. And then really like less than 1 to 2% chance that we're going to have side effects that we really, really need to get concerned about. So great question. Thanks for asking it. Something that comes up in every appointment.
An email from Tracy. Anaplasmosis is also a problem for horses. My gelding had a severe case and I almost lost him. More people need to be aware of it and be vigilant with tick checks and tick controls.
I agree.
We'll go to Lynn, who's calling from Sanford. Hi, Lynn. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to know, how do you remedy skunk spray?
Oh, I'm sorry.
So there's some good over-the-counter products. Nature's Miracle, I think, makes a skunk removal. You also can use, and I don't know the exact proportions, but peroxide, Dawn dish detergent, and baking soda will help. If you Google it, it will tell you the proportions. But beware, if you have a black dog or cat that has been skunked, it will bleach their fur slightly.
Oh, my. Permanently?
Not for permanently, a little while? But just kind of like you would use peroxide in your hair. It will eventually grow back, but you may end up with a slightly brownish animal for a little while.
All right. Well, thank you, Lynn, and good luck to you. An email from Daniel. I have a Bengal cat who loves to sunbathe for very long periods of time. If he's not in the sun, he lays down close to the bottom of the refrigerator where it's warm. I was wondering if it's okay for him to be exposed to the sun for so long. Should I be worried?
With him, you probably don't need to worry so much. We worry more about white animals or cats with a really sort of thin hair coat that you can see. So sure, you know, in an ideal world, perhaps you want to limit his sun a little bit. But really, we worry more about those light-skinned and light-haired cats being prone to getting cancer from the sun.
Is the cat soaking up the vitamin D like a human would be, or are they different?
Yeah, some of us are sun lovers, I guess. Yes, they are soaking up a little vitamin D.
We'll go to Victoria, who's calling from Arundel. Hi, Victoria. Go ahead.
Hi there. I have this tiny little toy fox terrier, and she's 2 years old, and she, about 6 months ago, started having, once a month or so, a spell that starts with losing her bladder, and then she sort of gets dizzy and drooling and sort of out of it, and then if I just sort of watch her close, she wakes up the next day back to normal.
So I, you know, if you haven't seen your vet, I would potentially, you know, definitely seek out your veterinarian. So it could be a couple of things depending on what size dog she is. You know, if she's a really tiny dog, we can see episodes of hypoglycemia that can cause symptoms like that. They kind of, the other thing that I would be concerned about would be something like a seizure, which can be, again, caused by a metabolic condition, or dogs can have a disease called idiopathic epilepsy. But you have to rule out metabolic causes first. So I think, especially if they're happening that frequently, definitely seeking veterinary attention and investigating that further is a good idea.
If it's something metabolic, is that easily fixable?
It depends on what it can be, but yes, it's at least you have an answer to start with.
Victoria, thanks for your call and good luck to you. Here's an email from Robin. She saw a post on our Facebook page, and the post is a picture of a Dutch rabbit named Bunny Boo Boo. And Robin's question is, that rabbit sounds like a great pet, but I'm wondering, do they use a litter box? Do they chew destructively?
They do use litter boxes. Mm-hmm. They can chew. And as far as are they a great pet, they're pretty delicate, so you want to be a little bit careful if you have small children in your house. But I think depending on your household and depending on your expectations, they can be good pets.
Definitely.
Kate on Facebook says, Emmy is a one-year-old rescue lab mix. We think Whippet or the like. She is active. We have so much fun with her. She's developed 5 small raised firm bumps the size of a big bite, 2 on each hip, back, rear, leg, shoulder. But not ticks, not red, and she doesn't seem bothered by them. They do not appear fluid-filled. Any ideas?
Those should definitely be checked out. They could be nothing. But anytime we have a lump or a bump on an animal that's been there for a bit of time, anything we notice something new like that, we definitely want to get them in and have them checked out and have them aspirated. So by aspirated, I mean putting a needle into that lump or bump and getting some cells out of it. It's a really, really easy way for us to tell, is that something that's benign, like a fatty mass or a cyst, even if it doesn't feel fluid filled, it may be. Or is that something malignant, something cancerous that we need to worry about? So one of my big messages is, if you've got lumps or bumps on your vet or on your pet and you're not sure what they are, take them in and get those lumps aspirated.
All right. And very quickly, I think time for one more call. So we'll go to Shelby in Ocean Park. Shelby, go ahead. And if you can be quick, that'd be great.
Yeah, sure. Hi. So my dog recently, I switched his food to more holistic, like moist food, like dehydrated. And all of a sudden he started passing all these stones, and they turned out to be cysteine stones. And the vet said that it's rare to catch them so early. And it's also a really rare crystal that's maybe genetically prone, and that the switching of the diet was actually probably helpful in shedding the stones rather than them just kind of getting bigger and bigger and bigger until he had a serious problem. So I'm very hesitant to switch to a prescription diet when what he was doing, what the switch was doing, was really beneficial. The only thing the specialist said was making sure that I'm doing the homemade diet so that it's alkalizing is the most important thing.
Okay, Shelby, we're almost out of time. Do we all have thoughts about an alkaline diet?
So I would say if you're not interested in doing a prescription diet, through your vet, potentially looking at a nutritionist formulating a homemade diet that you could make at home that would meet those specific needs would probably be the best way to go.
All right. Well, good luck, Shelby, with your dog. And that's going to be our last call for this hour. Always a popular program. I really appreciate both of you being here today. That was Dr. Carrie Whittemore, you just heard, a veterinarian with Falmouth Veterinary Hospital. And also here, Dr. Virginia Gill, a veterinary oncologist with the Maine Veterinary Medical Center. John Keimel ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and by Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, Young Adult Literature. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.